Chapter 2. The Law, Training and Practice. After college, the CIA wanted to interview me. Never seriously considered it. Did interview for the Foreign Service, U.S. State Department. Avoided interviews with corporations, and ultimately decided to attend law school. This was not so much a perception of law as a rational path to a life of social reform as a way station. The all-purpose graduate program. Law school could provide relevant training for business, government service, teaching, as well as the practice of law. It would provide 3 more years to mull over decisions about a career. Law school also appeared from a distance to offer rigorous training in analytical process. Once back in Austin, now in law school, I was not disappointed. Not all professors and students were equally gifted intellectually, but all at least seemed to be striving for excellence and tidiness of mind. Maybe I took it more seriously than other students, but probably not. We were reminded of Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes' admonition: "The business of a law school is to teach law in the grand manner and to make great lawyers." Remarks, Harvard College's 250th anniversary, 1886. Such an environment provided a felt obligation to develop one's knowledge and skills, as a medical student might feel, because of the professional responsibility, not to mention the grief one might forever carry at having inadequately protected another's fortune or life. Law school had its impact in a variety of ways. The first-year spirit was sometimes akin to what I imagined in a Marine Corps boot camp. The efforts and skills were different from an undergraduate college education. Success was guaranteed to no one, and long hours and hard work seemed the only possible response. Years later, The Paper Chase, 1973, a movie about law school, reminded me of my own experiences. The analytical skills dissecting court opinions and statutes, arguing from one line of cases to another, tend to be somewhat dehumanizing. Because of an occasional judge learned hand or Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes' opinion, there is some regard for good writing, and torts law injuries has occasional flashes of humor and passion for the plaintiff. But property, procedure, bills and notes, and the rest of the standard curriculum are generally in a metaphysical world all their own, kind of like playing three-dimensional chess and trying to remember where all the pieces are. And except for a rare Fred Rottle, Yale law professor and author, "Woe Unto You Lawyers," 1939, it is rare that anyone inside the legal establishment subjects the whole legal system to the ridicule occasionally deserved. The law school curriculum puts a heavy emphasis upon the rights of property, the rich, and large corporations. This has changed markedly in the last 20 years with courses in poverty law, civil rights, and consumer protection. But that revolution was only beginning in the 1950s, and even today the orientation of the curriculum in most law schools has not changed that much. I was uncomfortable with this emphasis, but not openly rebellious. The faculty was first-rate, largely due to the efforts of Dean Page Keaton, my torts professor. I worked as a student assistant. The law school title was Quizmaster for the prior dean, Connecticut McCormick, who was also my evidence and contracts professor. Another dean, Northwestern University School of Law, Leon Green, offered a course he created titled Injuries to Relations. I enjoyed. A brilliant and prolific young professor, Charles Allen Wright, taught my constitutional law class. He later came to be known to the legal profession for his work on the Federal Courts Treatise, and to the public for his defense of Richard Nixon. Others: Gus Hodges, Corwin Johnson, Miller Drude, George Stumberg, Jer Williams, Bill Young provided not only an understanding of their own specialized area of the law, but of legal ethics, professionalism and excellence. The Law Review experience was harrowing but invaluable. It was probably my first time in 19 years of schooling to be subjected to such rigorous training in writing and editing. A case note of a couple pages in the Texas Law Review, a discussion of a current court decision, could take 6 weeks to research, and 10 drafts to write and edit into something the editors would accept. My classmates and I talked over our plans after graduation. There were long arguments about the relative merits of large and small firms, a subject about which we had neither experience nor expertise. Some wanted to represent criminals and injured plaintiffs. Most were content to practice corporate and securities law with Texas' largest firms or oil company legal departments. During the short time I was in law school, we watched these firms' starting salaries go from $200 to $300 a month, and then $500. That kind of money was hard for law students to resist. Charlie Wright, as he was colloquially known to students, told me about the option called a judicial clerkship and ultimately sold me on the idea. After Yale Law School, he had clerked for Judge Charles E. Clark, U.S. Court of Appeals, Second Circuit. Clerking was then relatively new to University of Texas Law School faculty and students. Law clerks are young, all-purpose personal assistants to state and federal judges, usually selected for one-year appointments. They are unrelated to the position of clerk of the court, a relatively permanent administrative position serving judges, lawyers, and the public, receiving and providing access to legal papers. Judges select their law clerks from among the top graduates of the nation's law schools each year. The one-year rotation has disadvantages for judges, who are constantly training new assistants, but it does ensure judges will be rejuvenated and stimulated by law school's latest ideas and graduates. Judges are expected to decide and write their court's opinions, but much of a judge's legal research can be handled by law review quality new law school graduates. The law clerks probably have the better of the bargain. They are provided a year of paid postgraduate training in legal research, come to know rather intimately the workings of at least one judge's mind and decision-making process, meet members of the bar, and conclude their year ready to move into teaching, government or practice. Nicholas Johnson, What Do Law Clerks Do? Texas Bar Journal, May 22, 1959. Judge John R. Brown was appointed to the United States Court of Appeals, Fifth Circuit, in 1955 by President Dwight Eisenhower and expressed a willingness to take his clerks from the University of Texas Law School. Dean Keaton helped with Judge Brown's selection process, in return for which Judge Brown spoke at the law school's annual tax conference in Austin. I was not the top student in my graduating class, but had done well, served as articles editor of the Texas Law Review, and not incidentally made the highest grade in Dean Keaton's torts class. Judge Brown agreed to an interview, and ultimately hired me. In this country, the federal court system exists side by side with our state's court systems. Each has trial courts and appellate courts. The federal district courts are the federal trial courts. The United States Courts of Appeals are, for most purposes, the final tribunal for any appeal from a federal district court. Appeals can be taken from a federal court of appeals to the U.S. Supreme Court on a petition for certiorari, but unlike the courts of appeals, the Supreme Court can choose its cases. Out of thousands of requests, it may hear and issue opinions for fewer cases in a year than the FCC does in a week. Most will involve conflicts between decisions of U.S. courts of appeals, interpretation of the Constitution, federal statutes, or other significant principle of law. The states are clustered into 10 numbered regions, called circuits, each with its own federal court of appeals. At that time, the Fifth Circuit included the Gulf Coast states, from west to east, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. I had, and still have, a tremendous respect for Judge Brown, who at this time is Chief Judge of the Fifth Circuit. The contrast between his sense of humor and his position made him a spectacular public speaker and fun to work with. He had been an outstanding student at the University of Michigan Law School, had a good mind, and worked hard. Living and working in Houston, his previous specialty as a practicing lawyer was admiralty law, and he retained his interest in this salty and colorful bayou of the law. He took a real interest in his clerks. Although the judge lived in Houston, the court's official location was New Orleans. It also sat in each of the states in the Fifth Circuit, except Mississippi. Because the judge took his clerks with him, there was quite a bit of traveling and opportunity to experience America's segregated Southland. One of my first experiences involved his insistence that I use a dictating machine and alien technology previously unknown to me to compose my briefing notes on the cases coming before the three judge panels to which Judge Brown was assigned. My brief summaries of the facts and law were circulated to Judge Brown and the panel's other two judges. The thought of briefing real cases was exciting enough. The fact that judges rather than law professors were going to read and possibly be influenced by my analyses was intimidating. The prospect of dictating them without the chance for revision made it almost impossible for me to talk into the dictation machine at all. While I retain my respect for the seriousness of the legal process, it was a valuable, liberating experience to internalize the realization that these cases are decided by humans. One wants to be responsible, fair and thorough. But having done that, nothing is gained by prolonged agonizing. It's better to pick up and read the briefs, think through the facts and law to a conclusion, dictate the memo, and move on to the next one. One of my challenges in law school was trying to remember case names and holdings, the legal rule from the court's decisions. Most legal training involves techniques of analysis, legal research, or spotting the issues. There's not as much focus on memorizing legal rules as students of biology or history might confront when memorizing their facts. But a memory is required, and mine was relatively poor. What to do? Ultimately, this approach evolved: read the court's statements of facts and both sides' arguments, figure out how it should be analyzed and decided, then read the court's analysis and decision. If the judge's analysis and decision is analogous to my own, there is no need to remember that case. If those facts ever arose again, on a law school essay exam or later in practice, my instinct was equivalent to the law. Of course, case holdings have to be researched and cited in any legal opinion or brief. Only cases that did not square with my analysis and sense of justice would have to be memorized. This instinct proved a good guide through two clerkships, teaching, practice, and jobs as maritime administrator and FCC commissioner. It was certainly reassuring whenever Judge Brown and his colleagues would end up agreeing with the analysis in my memo. Even more so, of course, when the dissenting opinion of Judge Brown was supported by the Supreme Court. The Fifth Circuit judges were almost all men for whom I had great respect. There were no women, as was common in those days. Chief Judge Joseph Chapel Hutcherson, Jr., appointed 1931, Judge Richard T. Rives, 1951, Judge Albert Tuttle, 1954, Judge John Robert Brown, 1955, Judge Benjamin Franklin Cameron, 1955, Judge Warren Leroy Jones, 1955, and Judge John Minor Wisdom, 1957. Four of those seven lived well into their 90s. That year, 1958 to 1959, the civil rights cases were already beginning, and the Fifth Circuit's record was one of which all Americans could be proud, especially considering the flaming crosses in judges' yards and other social pressures they confronted. One of the men for whom I had greatest respect was U.S. Supreme Court Justice Hugo L. Black. My father spoke of him with admiration. I had read his opinions in government classes and law school and had long admired his tough insistence upon the basic provisions of the Constitution, his willingness to dissent, and his humanism. Each of the justices has a responsibility for a circuit, and Justice Black's circuit was the fifth, which contained his home state of Alabama. Although Justice Black was getting 100 or more applications from outstanding young lawyers for his clerkship positions, justices then had two. I decided to try for it. Judge Brown wrote a nice letter for me, and so did Judge Rives, who was from Alabama and probably the closest to Justice Black. The interview with Justice Black was really honor enough. That marble monument called the Supreme Court is one of the most beautiful and awesome buildings in Washington. When it opened, one justice is said to have refused to work there on grounds the only appropriate way to arrive would be on the back of a large white elephant. My first day, when my wife, Karen, drove north on First Street, pulled up and parked in front of the court to let me out, our six-year-old daughter, Julie, responded much like that justice. She took one look at the building, turned to me with a look of incredulity and asked, "Daddy, do you work in there?" Thereafter, my co-clerk, Jack McNulty, and I usually traded off driving each other to work. The courtroom itself is one of the grandest rooms in the country. But for a young law school graduate to be escorted by a guard past the black wrought iron gates, down a long, high-ceilinged marble corridor to an appointment with Justice Black in the inner sanctum of the building was a real thrill. As it turned out, he hired me, and I would regularly report to work there each day. But I never forgot the excitement of that first meeting, nor did constant exposure ever erode my real respect for Justice Black, known to his law clerks as the judge, the building, and the legal system it symbolizes. Much of my subsequent difficulty at the FCC is probably traceable to my experience at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court experience gave me a benchmark by which to judge the performance of other court-like institutions, a benchmark by which the FCC sometimes becomes a laughingstock. The standards to which the court holds itself, while necessary and commendable, are unrealistic for most institutions. It's unfair to hold the FCC to the same standards as the court in all cases. For starters, the FCC issues more opinions in an average week than the Supreme Court issues in a year. But it's not unfair when the Supreme Court's example is both applicable and attainable. The justices read the lawyers' briefs, attend the oral argument, discuss the case in closed conference and vote on the outcome. The Chief Justice designates the justice to write the majority opinion. It is written, circulated among, and certainly carefully read by the others. If the author and eight more sign on, it is a unanimous opinion. If a majority sign on, those disagreeing can write concurring or dissenting opinions. Occasionally a separate opinion is sufficiently persuasive to change other justices' votes. Justices write their own opinions. And to the extent their clerks offer research or debate the merits of a case with their justice, the court has the assistance of a couple of the nation's ablest law school graduates. At the FCC, by contrast, aside from my dissents, it was somewhere between rare and never that a commissioner would author either a commission ruling or separate opinion. Opinions are prepared by the staff of the relevant bureau, for example, Broadcast Bureau, Common Carrier Bureau, approved by the bureau chief, and put on the commission's Wednesday agenda. Indeed, given the complexity and length of many of the opinions, it's unlikely they were even closely read and comprehended by all commissioners if they were read at all. There was little, if any, contact between Supreme Court justices and practicing lawyers. For a justice to meet with a lawyer about his or her pending case was unthinkable. There were few phone calls or visitors of any sort. Having experienced the standards of the Supreme Court, it was difficult to avoid drawing contrasts with the FCC and encouraging my commission colleagues to do a little better where their roles are similar. Things are different at the FCC, and understandably so. The FCC is not just a court, hearing appeals from decisions of its staff and hearing examiners, the Regulatory Commission's trial judges, now called administrative law judges. It is also a legislative body, with the power to enact regulations set to have the force and effect of law, using a legislative process during which appropriate direct contact between legislators and interested parties may be acceptable. The Supreme Court deals with few lawyers or clientele on a regular basis, except the government's lawyer, the Solicitor General in the Justice Department. The FCC sees almost no one other than its regular customers, members of the Federal Communications Bar Association, major corporations, executives and lobbyists, all of whom are well known and often former colleagues and social friends of the commissioners and staff. Of course, it's more difficult for commissioners and staff to maintain a professional distance from their small, specialized clientele than it is for the Supreme Court justices to keep a distance from the entire nation's bar membership. But greater efforts could be made to police commissioners' social and other private contacts with industry representatives. At the Maritime Administration, a log was kept of every person entering the Office of Ship Construction. If every FCC commissioner's office and bureau at the FCC was required to keep a public list of the names and affiliations of individuals telephoning or visiting the agency, some of the grosser abuses would be reduced. There is a measure of insecurity and anti-intellectualism within the commission that discourages the use of able and dependent minds. There is also a lack of appreciation for the drawing power the commission could have. My hiring practices followed the court's law clerk model, high-quality young lawyers for one-year terms. Other commissioners could do likewise. Individuals with no interest in an FCC career might be willing to consider a one-year assignment in a commissioner's office. Scientists, systems analysts, economists and other social scientists who wouldn't think of accepting civil service status might be willing to serve on advisory committees or take phone calls. I never had difficulty drawing upon America's best minds. To be fair, It's not the staff's fault that there is likely to be more research, tight reasoning and intellectual content in an opinion that Supreme Court justices and their clerks have leisurely labored over for a month or more than one a low-level FCC civil servant has worked on for a day while attending meetings, handling phone calls, and answering congressional correspondence. But the failure to be analytical and precise, to cite serious research, books, articles, and court opinions, is motivated in part by the staff's awareness that commissioners don't want to make ringing declarations of principle that might bind their flexibility in future cases. Some of the commission's irrational opinions are the product of an affirmative effort to create obfuscation and flexibility. Long opinions may be unnecessarily so. Higher quality work could have been done in shorter space and time. For example, when I requested a brief pamphlet to explain our voluminous cable television rules to the small cable operators and public, the commissioners and staff refused to prepare it. The staff lawyers who had created the lengthy document soon left the commission and began charging cable operators legal fees for explanations. Another issue is the regularity with which major FCC decisions are reported in the trade press days before they are announced to the public. This can affect stock prices, constitute violations of law and good administrative practice. It stands in stark contrast to the Supreme Court's control of leaks and throws into question the propriety of the FCC's process. From the Supreme Court, I went to the faculty of the University of California at Berkeley, Bald Hall, for 3 years. I wrote the major law review article expected of all new professors, producer rate regulation in natural gas certification proceedings, CATCO in context, Columbia Law Review, 1962, created a casebook of teaching materials, unpublished, and was put through teaching the usual potpourri of courses, administrative law, administrative law seminar, business associations, corporations, equity, and oil and gas law. Bald Hall was and is by any standard one of our country's best law schools in terms of faculty and student body. It was yet another opportunity to be associated with first-class minds and serious research in the law school and throughout the university. Dean Bill Prosser, Torts, headed the school when I was hired, but I won't go through the names of all the faculty, many of whom are well known nationally and internationally within the academy. My principal interest soon focused on administrative law, and that meant a chance to work with the energized Renaissance man and newly chosen Dean Frank Newman. For most people, most of the time, law means what some civil servant is requiring them to do: pay taxes, pass driver's license tests, qualify for a beauty shop license, zoning permit, license to sell alcohol, or pay the regulated telephone rates. The success of our legal system is dependent upon the fair and efficient functioning of our administrative agencies. This revelation provided a logical melding of my interests in political science and law and proved to be an insight into things to come. I spent one summer studying the California Public Service Commission and came to know and work with others in the administrative law field such as Ken Davis, Walter Gulhern, and Louis Jaffe. But I soon came to realize my academic studies of administrative law were not adequate for what I wanted to research, write, and teach. I needed to add a hands-on experience of practicing administrative law. Covington and Burling, where I had spent the summer of 1957 as a law student, had flattered me with repeated offers after graduation: the clerkship with Judge Brown, the clerkship with Justice Black, and while at Bald Hall. Their interest was such that they were willing to take me on leave from Berkeley for 2 years to work on administrative agency matters. It was the largest firm in Washington and had an extensive administrative practice. It prided itself on the number of former Supreme Court law clerks working there, and partners who would go in and out of government. So much so that it was sometimes jokingly referred to as one of the larger government agencies. Much has been written about Covington and Burling by those who study the large corporate law firms in Washington and New York. At the time I worked there, 1963-64, it was still housed in the Union Trust Building at 15th and H Streets in downtown Washington. The firm later succumbed to the lure of modern office buildings and moved down the street to the new Motion Picture Association of America building a couple blocks from the White House, near the AFL-CIO building, Lafayette Park and Hay Adams Hotel. The halls were dark, furniture and rugs were old, offices were small and hard to find, and dictating equipment had not yet arrived. The 100 or so lawyers wore vests and short-cropped hair and preferred 30-second bursts of phone conversation to 5-minute office visits. They made millions of dollars for themselves and probably billions for their clients. The apocryphal story is told of how large legal fees began. In the very early days of the firm, the new young lawyers, now senior partners, were trying to decide how much to bill a corporate client for some litigation and drafting of legal papers. They finally screwed up their courage and asked the secretary to prepare a bill for $5,000. Anxiously awaiting whether it would be protested or paid, they were surprised when the return mail produced a check, not for $5,000, but for $50,000. Upon inquiry, they found the secretary had inadvertently added an additional zero and they were $45,000 richer. They have been adding an additional zero ever since and have seldom, if ever, received a complaint. They are, quite simply, the best lawyers in the business. Lawyers they're called. They seldom become involved in a case until some other firm has made a mess of things, comes to them for advice, or a corporate client is in over its head. Such clients are occasionally engaged in somewhat less than savory practices. They want to go on manufacturing the drugs that the Food and Drug Administration says are hazardous to health. Advertise in ways the Federal Trade Commission says are false and misleading. Dump waste products into rivers the Environmental Protection Agency says they're polluting. Drill offshore after they've spilled oil on beaches. Build the Alaskan pipeline. Strip mine for coal and clear cut for timber. Raise permitted airline rates from the Civil Aeronautics Board. And lower taxes from the Internal Revenue Service. It takes very good lawyers to obtain permission for their clients to engage in these highly profitable practices. In the 1950s and early 1960s, representing corporate clients in such ventures did not create the moral conflict for lawyers that it tends to today. What we today call the consumer or environmental movements didn't exist. Now there are at least small activist organizations, academic literature and small circulation magazines. Then a lawyer might never be confronted with a question of conscience, his, it was almost never a her, impact upon the earth and the life it sustains. There was professional pride in the quality of one's work, regardless of substance or impact. A satisfaction in the skillful use of one's talents. If the issue of propriety was ever raised, there could always be the lawyer's response, every client deserves the best representation available. There was reverence for process, and pride in one's ideological neutrality. In fairness, during the era of Senator Joseph McCarthy's communist witch hunts, many of these same lawyers were defending, often pro bono, without pay, those whose careers were being destroyed by mere allegations. If pressed, they would probably feel a total consistency in their actions. They hung out a shingle to represent whoever came along. Just as some doctors specialize in diseases of the rich while volunteering in free clinics, these lawyers specialize in the legal diseases of America's wealthiest corporations while occasionally serving the deserving poor pro bono. In fairness, Covington and Burling and many other law firms are not involved with their clients' political action, though they may prepare legal analyses for documents used by lobbyists. These lawyers do not lobby or carry cash to senators, hold off the record meetings with regulatory commissioners about pending cases, or schedule industry price-fixing meetings. The lawyer lobbyist is a special breed in Washington. Whatever the original intent of those who wrote the Constitution, the net effect has been that the very best legal talent is arrayed on the side of corporations and their wealthy owners. Little is devoted to representing the interests of consumers, taxpayers, television viewers, or other concerns of ordinary citizens. In fairness to the large firms, many have provided the lawyers who were sent out or opted out to establish the public interest law firms. They were among the first to offer lawyers to legal aid clinics. They have fought for small claims courts, court-appointed representation of criminals and other indigents. Many have not opposed the creation of neighborhood legal services or the Consumer Protection Agency, even though their clients might. The fact is that most of the efforts of consumer, environmental and other public interest organizations are directed at undoing what large law firms have done on behalf of their clients. And because the law graduates recruited by the large firms are, by definition, among the brightest and best educated young men and women our nation can produce, many of whom like to think of themselves as liberal to radical, they must confront the inherent conflict between their ideals and their jobs. Some resolve the problem by adopting the entire corporate lifestyle: expensive clothes, country clubs, vacation homes, travel. Some salve their conscience by returning each evening to their former lives of long hair, bell-bottom jeans and pot. A few insist on spending significant portions of their time and firm's resources on pro bono cases, fighting the very class of clients, though not the same clients, the rest of the firm is defending. Those unable to resolve the conflict leave for public interest law firms, government jobs or teaching. When I joined the firm for a 2-year term, I had no more sophistication and social conscience than other attorneys. The firm was representing tobacco companies the lawyers called the cancer lobby, though I did not do so. The companies sought to avoid governmental inhibitions on the sale of cigarettes, the Surgeon General's warning, cigarette smoking is hazardous to your health, the ban on advertising, or a possible ban on sales. I did not smoke and was even less inclined to start once learning all the young attorneys working on the cancer lobby account had quit smoking by the time I left the firm. I did not want to work on that project and would not have done so. But my lack of sophistication about the role of American corporate power was such that many accounts struck me as ethically and morally neutral. Today their negative influence would be more obvious. What I primarily ended up working on, in addition to representing the small airline Panagra, and the Venezuelan government regarding a ship seized in Philadelphia, was anti-dumping legislation. Businessmen tend to praise the theory of competition, but use pejoratives to describe its practice when it threatens to move in next door. For example, the Bell Telephone Company referred to any competitor's telephone equipment as foreign attachments. Similarly, our clients, American manufacturers of steel and cement, referred to the ultra-competitive pricing of steel or cement from abroad as dumping. There is some rationale for anti-dumping laws. Dumping is defined as selling goods in a foreign market below the price in the manufacturer's domestic market, sometimes even below the cost of manufacturing. Usually this is done to obtain a larger market share, or even drive some competitors out of the market. But it is a complicated matter indeed to settle upon a fair price when there is a dispute. And anti-dumping laws can be abused as a means of driving out all foreign competition. Our clients retained Covington and Burling to represent their interests with regard to the importation of steel and cement from Japan and elsewhere at prices believed by them to violate the anti-dumping laws. Donald Hiss was the partner handling the account, and it was a pleasure to work with him. He was an extremely able lawyer with a sense of humor well above the average for the firm. As the brother of Alger Hiss, he had a commitment to civil liberties and liberal causes, and my wife, Karen, had worked with Don's sister, Anna, at the University of Texas. What attracted me to the case was the possibility of creating an Administrative Procedure Act for anti-dumping cases. Administrative law was my field, and the prospect of studying the process the Treasury Department and Tariff Commission used in an esoteric area of the law like anti-dumping was my idea of getting paid for a good time. The bureaucratic maneuverings and relative insensitivity to rather elemental principles of due process were fascinating. Drafting a new Administrative Procedure Act to be introduced in Congress and possibly become law was heady stuff for a 28-year-old administrative law professor. The possibility my effort to import due process into the procedure might create an increase in the price of steel and cement in this country, lessen two basic industries' need for rapid technological innovation, and misdirect economic resources from relatively more competitive industries were matters of little concern at the time. My experience in studying the California Public Utilities Commission would have real-world impact in the cause of fair procedure. It seemed to me a worthy and educational undertaking. On November 22, 1963, I heard at lunch the news that President John F. Kennedy had been shot. ABC News maintains a window on Connecticut Avenue, and I watched the television report for a while. I asked the partner with whom I'd had lunch and been working that morning, not Don Hiss, whether we would take the afternoon off. He thought there was entirely too much sentimentality about the assassination and that it ought to be treated like any other workday. We walked back to our 15th Street office. There is an emotional hardening that can evolve in those growing up in any profession anywhere. But it seems worse in Washington. Ultimately, it got to me, until the reaction burst forth in a book I titled Test Pattern for Living, 1972. Whether from necessity or habit, there is a commitment to long hours, rock-hard efficiency, and putting a priority on work and career above family and social contacts. It seems more prevalent in Washington law firms and government agencies than elsewhere. I was very moved by the assassination of President Kennedy and the events live and televised surrounding it. It intensified my commitment to government service, the American dream, and my desire to participate in some way. A couple months later, I received an indirect indication that a government job might be in the offing.